the Royal Australian Air Force in person, 1921 to 2021. Ad Astra Aviator. This is a series of podcasts recounting the personal stories of veterans and their families. The narrator is Gareth McRae, OAM.
Air Chief Marshal Sir Angus Houston, aka AFC retired, was born in a very small place in the southwest of Glasgow, in Scotland, overlooking the Firth of Clyde. His father was a Royal Air Force officer who was shot down at a place called Hanzame in 1943. He was captured by Belgian collaborators and was handed over to the Germans. He became a prisoner of war in Stalag Luft No. 3, the Great Escape Camp. Sir Angus saw an Australian Air Force life of rotary wing flying in many types and operated in many challenging and sometimes dangerous roles. Sir Angus was promoted to Air Marshal and took over as Chief of Air Force on the 19th of June in 2001. Over 4 years, he led an extensive change in culture to put people first. He was also the first Chief of Air Force to achieve a zero fatal accident rate during his tenure. Sir Angus was promoted to the rank of Air Chief Marshal and appointed as Chief of the Defence Force in July 2005. During this time, he oversaw the successful deployment of 65,000 Defence Force personnel over 58 different operations. Sir Angus retired from the military as Chief of Defence Force in July 2011 after 41 years of service. On his retirement from the Defence Force, the government appointed Sir Angus as Chair of the Anzac Centenary Advisory Board, which provided strategic advice to the Australian government in relation to the planning and implementation of the Anzac Centenary 2014 to 2018. In 2012, he was appointed as Chair of Air Services Australia, a role he held until mid-2018, and Chair of the Defence SA Advisory Board, replacing the role held previously by General Sir Peter Cosgrove. In 2014, Sir Angus was appointed as the Prime Minister's Special Envoy to lead Australia's efforts to help recover, identify and repatriate Australians killed in the Malaysian Airlines Flight MH17 disaster. Today, Sir Angus continues to work in a number of major roles, including as Chancellor of the University of the Sunshine Coast and Chair of the Murray-Darling Basin Authority. Sir Angus is also the patron ambassador for numerous not-for-profit and charitable organisations, which he generously provides his time. Sir Angus is married to Liz, and they have 3 sons and 3 granddaughters. Just some of his honours, Australian honours, include the 1980 he was awarded the Air Force Cross for an open sea rescue in gale force winds in 1979. In 2001, he was awarded the Centenary Medal for outstanding service as Chief of Air Force. And in 2015, Knight of the Order of Australia for extraordinary and preeminent achievement and merit in service to Australia through distinguished service in the Australian Defence Force, continued commitment to serve the nation in leadership roles, particularly the national responses to the MH370 and MH17 disasters, and in a variety of roles within the community. Welcome, Sir Angus. Look, we really are delighted that you can join us. Let me start by asking you this. Your father was in the Royal Air Force. I'd like you to tell us a little bit about him, because I know he was shot down during World War II.
Well, he joined up as soon as he could. He was at university at the time doing engineering, Glasgow University, and he volunteered to join. He then went across the Atlantic Ocean, ended up in Oklahoma, a place called Ponca City, and did his initial training there. He flew the Stearman biplane, something that he always loved, and said there was never anything as good as a Stearman biplane in terms of comparisons with a Tiger Moth, for example. And then came back, went on to fly Hurricanes, and was on one of the first squadrons to be re-equipped with the Typhoon. He used to fly the Typhoon, I think 60 operational missions on Hurricanes and Typhoons, and eventually he was shot down.
Over Hans May?
A little village called Hansom, which is not far from Dixmuyde, as they call it. We'd call it Dixmude. And basically, I was very fortunate. After I finished CDF, I ran into the Belgian vice chief at a conference, a NATO conference at Brussels, and we started talking. And I said, yeah, I've got a bit of a connection with Belgium. My father was shot down in Belgium in World War II. He said, where? And I said, near Dixmuyde. He said, what date? I said, well, September of 1943. Anyway, he said, I will investigate that because I am part of a club that looks at the history of all aircraft that were shot down in Belgium in World War II. I guess 6 weeks later, I got a note from him, and he said, we have found somebody who was there when your father was shot down and saw your father marched into town and handed over to the Germans by the Black Shirts being the collaborators. And my father and his wingmen were attacking a train which had a AAA anti-aircraft artillery within the train, and both of them were shot down. My father was very lucky because they were at low level. He was able to bail out, and unfortunately, his wingman died.
And your father ended up in the same prisoner of war camp that was called, was part of the Great Escape.
Yeah, Stalag III. And he was there when the escape was effected. He told me once that his number was 211, and of course, when they got to 76, the whistle blew, and there was nobody else able to get out of the place. As you know, 50 were executed, extrajudicial killings by the Gestapo, many of them in the forests around the camp, and three got back to the UK, and the other 23 were put back into POW camp.
What was the outcome for Dad?
Oh, he survived. He got a permanent commission as soon as he got back from prisoner of war camp, then went on to serve until 1968 in the Royal Air Force. He was CO of a Vampire and then re-equipped with Venoms in Aden. After that, I went into a couple of ground jobs and then was lucky enough to get command of a Victor squadron, a V-bomber squadron at RAF Honington, flying Victors, obviously, as part of nuclear deterrent force that the Brits had mounted at that time.
So, Sir Angus, were you keen then to get into the RAF because of your father's experience, or had that something that you just had always been part of your desire?
Well, I was in the cadets. I was in the Air Force cadets. Reached the rank of warrant officer in the cadets.
Is this while at school? While at school.
While at school, yeah. We had a very active cadet organisation. We had Air Force, Army and Navy. Indeed, you had to spend the first year in the Army, and that was associated with the Black Watch. Although I didn't have a Black Watch kilt, the pipe band, as I recall, did. I had a flying scholarship, two flying scholarships while I was at school. I did one of those flying at Scone, not far from the school, on summer holidays. I was only 10 hours in a Cessna 150, went solo. And then at the end of my school time, I got a flying scholarship, an RAF flying scholarship, and I went down to Skegness in Lincolnshire and flew Austers.
Yeah.
Tail draggers. I really enjoyed that. That was a very demanding little aeroplane to fly, and I loved every minute of it. Did 30 hours on it, and then shortly after that, I applied to join the RAF.
But a problem.
There was a problem.
You were too tall.
I was too tall, yes. According to the flight surgeon who measured me, I passed all the tests, and they said, look, there's just one little problem. You're a little bit tall, and we'd like you to go and do a cockpit check at Little Risington. So I went down there. I went in, and there was a flight surgeon who was clearly very busy. He looked at me. He said, oh, you're very tall. Sit down here. He measured my sitting height, and he said, yes, you've got a very long back. And we then went out to a jet provost, and he said, put me into an ejection seat. And without any adjustment to the seat or anything, he just looked at me. He said, see, you're too tall. See the handle? You'd have to pull it up and then pull it down over your face, and that would be very hard to do. You're too tall.
Wasn't the seat adjustable?
Of course it was, and as I discovered when I went on to fly Mackies, the first thing I was asked to do when I got into a Mackie was to adjust the seat downwards. Once you adjusted the seat downwards, I fitted quite comfortably into a Martin Baker Mark IV seat.
So much for that person back in the RAF. Anyway, we'll leave him aside. The family decided to move to Australia.
No.
What happened?
I decided to
You
move.
Decided to? Why?
Yeah, well, I was, at the time, I was a business commercial apprentice
right.
at a steel company, part of the United Steel Group. And one day I was sitting there, and I was doing 6 months at college, 6 months with the company. And I was sitting there on a hot summer's day, and I saw this guy sitting there, and I looked at him, and I asked him, how long have you been in this office? He said, oh, I've been here for 30 years. And I thought, well, I don't want a life like that. And I, spur of the moment, I thought, that's it. I'm not going to stay with this. And I went down to London and went to Australia House. And in those days, every state had an office on the Strand, in that stretch of the Strand that runs up to Australia House. I went into each of them, and I was really taken with West Australia. The last frontier, I think they called it at that stage.
I think it might still be that string.
Well, I think they're still calling it that. But certainly I was attracted by that, so I applied to go to Australia. And obviously, for the princely sum of £10, I was eventually approved.
Well, why not Canada? Because, I mean, surely the same opportunities would have not Air Force opportunities, but open air spaces.
Oh, I was just taken with Australia.
Yeah. I'm so glad.
And basically, well, it's worked out.
Yeah, funny about that, isn't it? Yeah, you're only 21, right, when you come to Australia? That,
no,
20. And that was in 1968-ish?
Correct, yeah, 1968.
Now, how did you end up on a cattle station? That's a quite...
Well, I was taken with, you know, before I... departed, I looked at all the things I might do in the first instance, and I decided I wanted to get out into the bush. I read some of the Australian classics, and I decided I wanted to see this magical bush that all the...
So were you a Henry Lawson fan?
Henry Lawson was one of them, yeah. Banjo Paterson, I've got some Banjo Paterson as well and read that. And I decided, I'd like to go out and have a look at the bush. When I got to Perth with about £100, one suitcase, I went to an employment agency and said, I want to go out to the bush. And this guy who got the job for me eventually, he was... He was a veteran of Tobruk, and he took me on board. He was very warm towards me, and I was prepared to go anywhere. And he said, look, I found the place. It's in a place called Muckenburden. And he said, here's the job. A couple of days later, I was on a bus on the way to Muckenburden. And there I stayed for 2 years before joining the Royal Australian Air Force.
Is that where... the Angus part of your name?
Because it wasn't, No. They call me there. I became known as Sam.
Sam?
Or General Sam. Or simply the General. And that's because of... I told a story one night as a bit of a joke about General Sam Houston of the Alamo. So, anyway, as soon as I told that story, I became Sam. But the interesting thing is, when I joined the Air Force, I said, my name's Alan Houston. Most people call me Sam. And at the end of the first couple of days, they were calling me Angus. I'm not quite sure why, but I think it had something to do with...
your background.
My background, and maybe something to do with Aberdeen Angus too. I don't know.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Where did the jump to the Air Force come about? What made you decide that? I'm going to give it another go, even though I'm tall?
Well, the first year I was on the farm, essentially we had too much water. We had a reasonable year, but the next year we had no rain at all. We had a drought. Mm. So it was very evident that, you know, things were going to get pretty tough. And at that stage, wheat quotas came in, and the wheat quota we were going to get would not enable me to continue share farming. And, of course, the drought came through. We had a very bad year. I didn't get paid that year. Essentially, I left the farm broke and joined the Air Force, the best move I ever made.
And did you join in Perth in Western Australia?
I was sworn in Perth, yes. And
transferred
and
then where?
And then got on the Red Eye Special from what was then Trans-Australia Airlines into Essendon and out to Point Cook. Joined number 76 pilot's course, 12 weeks at Point Cook, flew the Windjewel, and then came back to Perth to fly the Mackie at Pierce.
You remember what that jump felt like, Windjewel to Mackie?
Oh, the Windjewel was much harder to fly than the
really?
Mackie. Oh, yeah. The Mackie was a delight to fly. Yeah, it was an easy transition.
So learning on the Windjewel, which was hard to fly, really, if you could do that well, then transferring to something that was easier to fly made you look like a really good pilot.
What was happening back then, the 15 hours at Point Cook on the Windjewel, it was really flight assessment. So it was a, if you like, a culling process to weed out anybody that would have problems getting through the pilot's course. Because the pilot's course, I say the Mackie was easier to fly, but a lot of the phases on the pilot's course are quite demanding, and certainly you need to have people who shall we say have the right feeling for.
Sure. Did your height ever in the early stages ever become never an issue?
Never an issue again. Well, no, it was an issue later, but when I went to Singapore, I was loaned to the Singapore Air Force as a flying instructor. I was initially, they said, well, we'd like you to fly the Marchetti. And all the Australians who'd been loaned to the Singapore Air Force at that time said, oh, no, he won't fit. And, of course, I went and did a cockpit check there, and I didn't fit. Fundamentally, the headroom, it was a curved, and I would have had to have flown with my
head on the side. So yeah. What happened?
I went to fly Strike Masters, which was much more to my liking. Because that was a great jet. We did the advanced part of the course, and we also did a bit of fighter lead-in training
as well.
This is
while in Singapore?
In Singapore.
You were there, how many years? 3-4 years?
Just under 2 years, 18 months, actually.
Okay, and then the next, you were then posted to Utah, Hill Air Force Base in Utah?
Yeah.
Why was that done? What was the reason?
Well, if we go back, I flew choppers off pilot's course. I was posted to, after a short time at Williamtown, I went to fly helicopters.
Was that your decision or the Air Force's decision?
No, it's what I applied for at that stage. I was keen to go to Vietnam. So I went to, I was posted down to Canberra, did the helicopter conversion. Halfway through the helicopter conversion, in came the word that we were, the Whitlam government had just recently arrived, and we were to withdraw from Vietnam. So I never went to Vietnam, and I guess once I did the conversion, I stayed in 5 Squadron for the next 3 years. Mm.
And 5 Squadron was the training section as opposed to 9 Squadron, the actual people in the war zone, during Vietnam War, that is.
Not really. It's, 9 Squadron was the operational squadron deployed in Vietnam, but 5 Squadron was both had a training flight and it had an operational flight well. And did all the operations, for example, preparing army units to go to Vietnam. The first thing I did when I graduated was fly up to Queensland with, there were 3 helicopters. I was a co-pilot at that stage. And we spent a week up in the Daybra area in the National Forest up there, preparing an army battalion to go to Vietnam. Mm. And of course, they only went for a short time, but they did deploy to Vietnam, and we did their, I think it was their final workup exercise before they deployed to Vietnam.
So you really technically did have some sort of role as far as Vietnam is concerned, even if it's only in the training phase.
Oh, I would say, you know, at that stage I was co-pilot. I learnt a lot, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, to all intents and purposes, you know, I flew operationally with 5 Squadron in a peacetime environment.
Sure, sure. And what was the purpose behind the posting to Hill Air Force Base in America?
Well, it was an exchange posting, and the previous exchange had been down in New Mexico, but the incumbent didn't think it was the right place for the exchange, and suggested that Hill would be a better place to go. And I flew twin Hueys, twin-engined Iroquois, if you like. I really enjoyed that. It was all high altitude, hot and high in the summertime, incredibly demanding in wintertime because of the snow, the fast-moving cold fronts, and so on. Mm. So it was a great place to fly.
And how long were you there?
I was there for 3 years.
3 years?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the developing relationships then between the US personnel and you, or and the Australians, what was that like and how did that work?
It was great, actually. I went in there, and the squadron had had an Inspector General inspection, and it didn't do well. I went in, and I was made the safety officer initially. There was certainly some things that needed to be sorted out there. I sorted them out. And as a consequence of what I did there, basically I became an instructor virtually straight away, and then I was made the operations officer of the unit. That meant I controlled the operations, the training, and everything that we did operationally.
Is that where you acquired is that where you acquired not the skill so much, but the notion, the idea of the need? Because I know as Air Chief Marshal, you others have spoken very highly about this role. You really did bring about a change in culture within the Royal Australian Air Force in the sense that you put people first, or the organisation should put people first. Is this experience in the United States of America where you acquired that notion? That
well, I think I acquired that sort of valuing of those that you work with in 5 Squadron. When I started flying 5 Squadron, you go away with initially a single aircraft and a crew, but also maintainers, and we might be away for 2 or 3 weeks, and you know, you got to know the guys that were maintaining the aeroplane, and you really gained a lot of appreciation for what they did. You respected them very highly, and you treated them the only way you could get the job done was work as a team. Mm. So I guess it started there, but as I went further and further up the Air Force, I recognised that it's all about people.
Sir Angus, how does one person change an organisation's culture?
Well, through leadership, and usually leadership. Most important dimension of leadership is to lead by example and treat everybody with respect and give them the message of what you expect of them. And I always have emphasised collaboration and teamwork. Mm. In the early stages, it was more about teamwork. But when you get to the strategic level as a CDF or a Chief of Air Force, it's much more about collaborative leadership. And, you know, I guess when I got to CDF, you know, there's a book about leadership that was commissioned by myself and David Hurley, who followed me. And it talks about my era of leadership as CDF, as the collegiate era. So I endeavoured to, rather than to have what had happened historically, fights between Army and Navy with Air Force, and the Chief of Navy was reported to leave the room with a red face, and you know, he's clearly upset. We didn't have any of that stuff on my watch. If there was a difference, we'd sit down and talk about it, and talk about it in a constructive way. And we maintain very, very good constructive relationships with across the leadership group.
So did that then, that new way, filter then down, let's just stay on the Air Force side, did that then filter down through the ranks in the Air Force, and everyone saw the value of doing that same approach as you were initiating in at that top level?
Well, the people first, I called it people first, people before platforms, because we were heavily criticised. When I came to the job, I was day three, and I was sitting out looking out of that lovely view the Chief of the Air Force has of the Brindabellas and the lake, and I had a visit from the, I guess, the person who was running the Board of Inquiry on the reseal deseal maintenance program on the F-111s. And he started his pitch because this was the, you know, the final step to brief the chief about what had been found. He said, Air Marshal, you have a problem. You have a culture that puts platforms before people. And in terms of when you went through the report, he was absolutely right. The people who'd been doing that maintenance were not well treated. They reported feeling sick and ill, and their supervisors said, oh, they're just malingerers, they're trying to get out of doing a dirty job. In actual fact, they were getting the first effects of dealing with the toxic material. And as we know now, it had life-changing consequences for a lot of the workforce. The other thing was the when they went up to medical to talk to the doctors again did not blow the whistle. They essentially treated them as if they were
malingerers
doing a difficult, dirty job, not the fact that they were actually suffering the first symptoms of some very serious illnesses that a lot of them got. So it was a failure of Air Force leadership, and there was a need to do something about that. So my catch cry for the next 4 years was
people first.
People first, people before platforms.
And is that what resulted in your watch, zero fatalities, which is a pretty significant record as Chief of Air Force?
Well, that was certainly part of it, but I think the zero fatalities, I mean, touch wood, this is in the flying environment.
Yep.
Touch wood. Air Force, the last time Air Force had a fatality was, I think it's the 18th of April, 1999. And here we are, touch wood, 23 years later.
Yeah, that's
and we're still zero.
Zero, yeah.
So it wasn't just me. And in fact, I put it down, the person who started, if you like, chiefs, we're always concerned about safety, but the person who really nailed what needed to be done was Les Fisher. And Les Fisher came in, and I remember him standing up in the one of the, I think it was a theatre at the convention centre, and he said, "Now listen here, you lot. There are going to be no accidents, no fatal accidents on my watch. If anybody breaks discipline and does something that is unauthorised, they'll be out I'll deal with it very harshly. And I expect all of you to lead from the front and make sure that we maintain very, very high standards. So he started that. He got somebody in from the RAF to do an audit. And I remember I was an OC wing at the time. And we all got together. He wanted us to get together. And he would sit there at the end of the table to start the round table we're going to have over a two-day period and tell us exactly what he wanted. And then we would sit down and, as the people who were controlling the operational wings, how we were going to deal with it. Essentially, we got there. And so to a large extent, what was required by me when I took over office was to maintain the very good flying safety culture we had, the airworthiness culture and system that we had, and to basically reinforce the risk management systems that we'd put in place to manage risk. So yes, we made changes and refinements. But the hard work had been done before. Yeah. And let me just put it in context. If you look back to the 1980s, we lost 27, this is across the whole Defence Force, 27 aviators killed in peacetime training accidents. Essentially, there were 60 aircraft lost. This is the decade of the 80s and the year 1991 when we lost a 707. So in 11 years...
That's a significant...
And in fact, if you take 91 as well as that decade, we lost 41 people. In the whole time we were in Afghanistan... on the battlefield, we lost 41 killed in action. So in a shorter period of time. So it's a or about the same time. It was a period of 12 years or whatever it was. So it was actually more dangerous to fly
In peacetime.
In peacetime in an Air Force aircraft doing training.
Thank goodness that was able to be changed. Let me just go back to the earlier part of your career. You, I believe, received the Air Force Cross for an open sea rescue. Do you recall that? And if you do, can you just tell us all about that?
Yeah, I was I was September 1979, and I was we used to maintain a crew on search and rescue standby. I think from memory it was a half-hour response or something like that. I just got to work that morning and basically there was a call out. There had been a mayday call from a vessel in distress off Evans Head. The weather at the moment was at that moment was appalling. Gale force winds and very, very high seas. In fact, the vessel should not have been where it was. It should have stayed in port. It was a motorised vessel that was on a delivery voyage from Singapore, where the vessel had been built, to Sydney. And it had been hit by a massive wave that had, caused a structural failure at the front of the boat, and the water poured in, and they had to take to the sea. Two of the people aboard scrambled into a dinghy, and the other three went into the water. So we were scrambled from Amberley. It was a long flight down because we had incredible headwinds, and from memory our ground speed was somewhere between 50 and 60 knots. Mm. And when we got to Evans Head, we put down at the range helipad, and we waited because there was a C-130 out there. There were a lot of search aircraft out there over the water looking for the survivors. Well, we waited most of the day, nothing. And along came a P-3 that diverted into the...
What is a P-3?
Sorry? P-3 was a maritime patrol okay. aircraft, big four-engine. The P-3s flew over water all of the time.
Okay.
The crew, they have a big crew, all trained in search and rescue. Believe it or not, they were in the area for about 30 minutes or so, and they found survivors in the water. So they dropped smoke, and they went around a couple of times. They located three people in the water, and smokes were dropped mm-hmm. in appropriate places. We were called out, and we were given a radar vector by the P3 out to the area because the visibility was not good at low level because
still in
of
gale
the
force
spray.
Winds and spray.
Yeah, very strong winds and a lot of sea spray and reduced visibility. So they got us out to the area and then they directed us towards the first survivor. And we had an incredible difficulty in finding the survivor. We had the smoke, but finding the person in the water with all this white water to excite the eye was incredibly hard. Anyway, we eventually sighted the first survivor and we set up for a hoist. So the way we did it was the pretty standard way you would do a rescue at sea. We had two loadmasters and we put Sandy Roman down on the... on the hoist. We were quite high because of the amount of breaking water. He went down, it was probably about a 50 foot winch. He got the first survivor, and while he was on the way down, he was buffeted by, he was hit by a huge wave, which he said took his breath away. Anyway, he got to the survivor, picked up the survivor, and we then hoisted them up into the helicopter, and we did the same for two more people. The challenge for me was just to maintain a good hover so that we didn't wander all over the place.
So without any frame of reference, as I've understand it, for a helicopter pilot, you need that to keep the hover. How did you manage?
Well, you use the... the breaking water, there's always there's always a reference that you can use, and you obviously need to cross-reference to the horizon,
sure.
maintain a a normal hover attitude, but at the same time maintain your position in space by broken water around
right,
you.
Right.
Okay. So that's how we did it.
And how many?
There's a loadmaster in the back who says tells you if you start to move. We didn't move. We're over the survivors.
And you got all three. Time.
We got three. Yeah.
Wow.
And then there was the two people in the boat. We got the survivors in. They were they'd been in the water for the best part of. 8 hours.
Hypothermia.
They were very cold, but they were able to talk. And we said, "Well, where are the other two?" And they told us that the other two had jumped into a dinghy, which was last seen 8 hours before, going downwind at very high speed. So we stayed out there and we did a. An expanding search
in circles
along the
zigzagging.
We assumed we saw where the wind was, and we went downwind. And we went along the route, a zigzag along the route is
yeah,
the best
right.
way to describe it. And we did that for quite a while until we had to go back, drop off our survivors at Ballina and go for a refuel. And last light was fast approaching, so we stayed the night at Ballina.
And did those two people in the dinghy get found?
No, they were not found alive. So 3 days later, somebody found one of them and the dinghy on the beach, well to the north of where we'd been searching.
This seems, out of a previous interview that I've had with a helicopter pilot, that in the Royal Australian Air Force, the helicopter and its crew seem to be more, of all of the divisions, seem to be more hands-on, people-centred than a fighter pilot or a person, an engineer or whatever. The helicopter seems to have a heart that a lot of the other sections don't have. Would that be a fair assessment of...
Well, in that era, to be completely fair about it, in that era, the only squadrons that had the maintenance people as part of the operational level maintenance people as part of the unit were the helicopter squadrons and the caribou squadrons. Mm. All the other units were supported by centralised maintenance squadrons. And if you talk to a troop, as I did, I talked to everybody in 9 Squadron, every single person, because we had obviously the transfer to the Army coming up, and they were all mortified because the opportunity of being really close to flying activity was going to be denied them because they would be going back to depots and large centralised maintenance organisations where there wasn't the close contact with the operation. And of course we used to do lots of deployments and we always took maintenance people, flight fitters, with us. Mm. And to a lot of maintenance people, that was why they joined the Air Force.
Yeah.
To be, you know, they wanted to maintain aircraft, but they wanted to be part of the operation. And I guess the way we operated, we provided that opportunity for them. And, of course, because we operated that way, it had to be teamwork, and it didn't matter who it was.
Yeah.
Here
comes the importance of that team again. I mean, you're inundated all around you with this impinging on what's shaping you and framing your attitude. We just look at some of your history with 9 Squadron. It's your first posting to a command position, I believe, or was.
Yes,
Yeah, that was 1987-ish?
1987, yeah.
Okay. You were involved with 3 things I want to ask about. You were involved with the introduction of the Black Hawk. Would that be correct?
Well, the job I had to do at 9 Squadron, essentially government had made a decision to transfer the helicopters to the Army. But at the same time, we were introducing a new helicopter, the Black Hawk. So the number one task, the first task was to introduce the Black Hawk to service. The second task was after a year at Amberley, moved to Townsville, a bit over a year actually, probably around 15 months, relocate the squadron to Townsville, and then once established at Townsville, on the, wait for it, the 14th of February, St. Valentine's Day, 1989, hand over the unit, lock, stock and barrel, to the Army. And, of course, I and all the troops who were with this squadron at the time went across to the Army. And the first big change was, because of the way the Army worked, I went into command A squadron, and I didn't have any maintenance troops. I just had air crew, and basically the troops went to the aviation maintenance workshops, and we were all part of a larger unit called Aviation Regiment, which was more like an Air Force wing than basically anything else.
As a helicopter pilot, as a person who joined the RAAF, how sad or difficult was it to see those helicopters now come under the command of Army, not Air Force?
Well, that was one of the leadership challenges I had. Obviously, I was, when the decision was made on the 18th of November, 1986, I was dismayed. And I remember going down to the little hole in the wall we had at Russell Offices at the time, and somebody said, oh, that's a terrible decision. I pity the poor bastard who has to implement that. I was that
you,
poor.
You were.
So in essence, what was required when I got to 9 Squadron was to... I remember I arrived and a couple of people said to me, "We're going to fight this. We're going to fight this decision, aren't we, boss?" Well, anyway, I stood up and I said, "Listen, I don't like that decision any more than you do, but it's a decision that's been made by the government of the day, and our job is to implement that decision."
Do you know why the decision was made?
The decision was made. Because personalities at the time had been, shall we say, upset with the way the Air Force operated helicopters in Vietnam.
But I won't get involved in
that discussion. That was all in the past.
Yeah.
And there was a view that battlefield helicopters should be operated by the Army, not the Air Force.
That, is like saying that the patrol boats operated by the Navy should be operated by the Army because they're close to they operate close to land. For me as a lay person, it seemed at the time, if it flies, surely it's Air Force.
Well, it's these arguments were around at the time, but the that was the way it was. The chain of command was 100%. We have to do the transition, and of course, the as it's turned out, the way we operate now, we're very much a much more joined up Australian Defence Force, and it doesn't matter who owns the capability because the CDF runs the show.
There still is a friendly rivalry across the...
There is. There's a esprit de corps from individual services. Sure. But at the end of the day, every operation that we mounted on my watch, and there was basically 58 of them, those 58 operations, every single one of them was a joint operation to some extent.
Let's go to when Iraq invades Kuwait and the Gulf War of 1990-1991. What was your involvement in that?
Well, I was JOPS 3, and I was the Air Force Wing Commander in the operational headquarters that was run by the Assistant Chief for Operations, ACOPS. I and my Army and Navy counterparts at the Wing Commander level were very much involved in, running the operations that were being conducted in the Middle East. And the way it used to operate then, we didn't have the permanent arrangements we have now. We'd bring in a whole lot of shadow posted people, probably about 30 people who would come into the headquarters, and they would be part of the operational team that would manage the workload. The fact that we were conducting wartime operations, and indeed it was on my watch in the middle of the night where Australia became involved in its first war since the Vietnam War. I remember it quite vividly because I thought, my God, we're at war. But as it turned out, it was all over quite quickly, but there was lots of things to worry about. And on my watch, there was a need to be concerned about. I was the Air Force staff officer, and we had an Army staff officer and a Navy staff officer. The Navy staff officer had most of the work because it was naval ships that were committed to the Allied Task Force. I had the job of all the exchange officers that were with units that were deployed into the Gulf. I was involved in doing the coordination to enable them to be deployed into the Middle East with their respective units. And of course, the other thing I had to worry about was evacuation. If there was something really bad had happened and there was a need to evacuate our people, our civilians, who were many of whom were in places like Saudi Arabia at the time and the other Gulf states, we would mount an evacuation operation.
What was the interaction like between the Australians and the other allies?
Oh, it's very good, very good. I went over there and for a short period of time, and I spent time in Oman, Bahrain, and Riyadh, and the relationships were absolutely first class. We always operate well with the Americans and the Brits, and they were both heavily involved.
Sir Angus, let me just run through some dates and then ask you to talk about some particular decisions and tasks that you undertook. 2001, you become Chief of Air Force, then Air Chief Marshal, then Chief of Defence Force in 2005, responsible for 65,000 defence personnel in 58 operations across the globe. Let me just take you through some of the decisions when you are the boss and ask you to reflect on them. In 2001, you had a role in the Children Overboard affair. At 2002, at a Senate inquiry, you challenged the government's claims. Can you reflect on that for me?
Yeah, well, yes, I can. I was acting Chief of Defence Force in, I think it was November of 2001, and at the time there was a lot of focus on what was happening in our neighbouring waters, and there was starting to be a number of boats that had, were carrying asylum seekers entering our waters. And on this occasion, there was a bit of controversy over one of the suspected illegal entry vessels, which is carrying asylum seekers. And the government had said they're even throwing their children overboard about this vessel. Essentially, some photography came in which demonstrated very clearly that children hadn't been thrown overboard. And there was a report in the in the Australian on that day with a photograph that suggested that children were being thrown overboard. And I phoned up the then minister and told him there was the reports and the photos and the sort of reporting associated with the photographs that children had been thrown overboard was not correct. No children had been thrown overboard. There was a couple of things happened after that, which are probably not relevant to the question. But later, I went to my first Senate estimates as Chief of the Air Force, and very quickly, Senator Faulkner focused in on the asylum seeker operations that had been conducted, and went straight to this issue of children overboard. He went through a number of people, and then I was asked to go up to the... I was asked to come to the table and take his questions, because I had been acting in the capacity of the Chief of the Defence Force. And... he asked me the questions, and I told the truth. And basically, that was then a big headline the next day.
I remember the headline.
Yeah, the headline was that I'd sacrificed my career by telling the truth. And there were all sorts of things around at the time in the Parliament. I think it was Costello who had said, we'll use an Exocet to take out something like that, take out...
Chief of Air Force. Given that so many other people have said, at your level, we have three areas that we're responsible for, government, the defence minister, the bureaucracy, and the service personnel. You reporting to government, that must have been rather challenging post that event, to actually still have a relationship with the government, was it, or did that just pass by?
Well, actually, by the time it became an issue, it became an issue in February of the next year, 2002, when Faulkner at Estimates went through a forensic questioning of everybody who'd been involved with the asylum seeker operations. So at that stage, the defence minister that I referred to had retired, the defence minister I was then working for was Robert Hill. And Robert never said anything to me that never said you did the wrong thing or anything like that. Never said it. Didn't say anything. The Prime Minister, I didn't have much direct interaction with the Prime Minister at the time. I saw him from time to time, though. I continued as the Chief of the Air Force. I continued to do my job. And the Prime Minister, when I invited him along to be part of a ceremony or something, always came, always very pleasant, never held it against me, and indeed eventually appointed me as the Chief of the Defence Force.
Yeah, so, I think if they had made an issue or done something or fired you or whatever, it would have really rebounded on them badly, because all you did was tell the truth. You know, and what's the adage? The truth will set you free. Let's go to 2012 then. The then Prime Minister, Prime Minister Gillard, asked you to chair a group to examine the asylum seeker policy and recommend some solutions. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a very demanding job. At the time, we were getting lots of boats and thousands of people arriving in Australia, And, of course, there was also a huge safety issue in that a lot of them, several, certainly tens and tens of them, were drowning at sea. I think it was well over 100, maybe a lot more. So our job was to, our terms of reference were to find a way to basically deal with these circumstances, and was there a better way of dealing with it. We looked at many options. If you remember, there was the Malaysian solution. We thought the Malaysian solution was a very good solution, so we had a look at whether we could get that started up, and we consulted very widely. We only had 6 weeks. We talked to everybody, and I mean all the people who had very strong views about what the government was doing in terms of handling the boat people. Andrew Wilkie, for example, the Greens, and all the civil society who were involved in supporting refugees and asylum seekers and so on. So we cast the net very wide to get all the advice we could as to, you know, well, where do we go from here? Is there a better way? And one of the things we were very keen to explore was perhaps have a whole of regional approach, similar to what had happened after the Vietnam War, where there was a place in Indonesia where all of the displaced people went to, and then what happened from there? The international community took Vietnamese, and they went to every corner of the globe, and it was a very successful endeavour. We tried to get something like that set up, but there was no way.
No.
There was no appetite for that. No way to do it. So, we're having all these people dying at sea. How can we? How do we handle that? We've got to deter people from coming. So we had a look at all of the options for deterrence, and it seemed to us that the only thing we could do is fall back on arrangements whereby if people come, they don't come to Australia. They're
offshore.
They go offshore, and they're processed offshore, so offshore processing. So we recommended that, but we also recommended a lot of other things to, if you like, give a lot more balance to the arrangements that were to be put in place. And we advised the government, don't cherry pick. It's a whole package.
Yeah.
Go for the whole package, because there were things we suggested that needed to be done in countries like Pakistan, Afghanistan, and all of the other places where people were coming from, and that didn't happen. They just
cherry-picked.
They cherry-picked and went straight for Nauru and Manus.
Yeah.
So that's how.
Let's jump then to 2014, Prime Minister Abbott. In fact, let's combine two. 2014, we've had the disappearance of MH370 and also the MH17 that was shot down, coincidentally, over Ukraine, as what's happening today. But what was your role there, and what were your discoveries?
Well, for 370, I was the chief coordinator, if you like, and my job was to handle the media and to handle all of the people that were affected by the tragedy. And I guess in handling the media, the other thing I needed to do was engage with the countries that had lost people in the terrible disaster of the loss of MH370. So fundamentally, I ended up dealing most normally with the Chinese ambassador and then everybody in Malaysia from the Prime Minister down, Prime Minister, Minister, and the ambassador in Australia. I also had to deal with Malaysian Airlines. And what we were preparing for was we obviously had to, there was the search that was ongoing and the need to keep everybody informed of anything that was significant, a significant change, which we did with press conferences. But the other thing was we needed to plan for what do we do when we find it, if we find it. What'll happen is a large population of Chinese in particular will descend on Perth and will want to have some sort of ceremony to remember their deceased. So we did all of that. So we had to engage to do that. We had to engage with the West Australian government, who were very helpful. The Premier and his chief of the Premier's department were fabulous. Anything we wanted, we got. Indeed, we got the Premier's briefing room for our press conferences on a regular basis. And these were huge press conferences. I mean, they had, you might remember, a lot of them were out at Pierce.
Yes.
Well, the government wanted the pressmen out of Pierce and into town. So my job was to no more press conferences at Pierce, let's do them in town. And it all worked quite well. And of course, radio interviews, Fran Kelly, 7:30 report, late line, the whole box and dice. And the press conferences were really interesting. It was standing room only in the Premier's briefing room. Sometimes I think probably a couple of hundred people in the room, and many of them were Chinese, and the Chinese were not getting a look in. So I decided we'd go with a two-language approach. So we did the first press conference in English, and then we did the second one in Mandarin with an interpreter. And that worked wonderfully well. And
these are all decisions you were responsible for.
Oh, yeah. No, I was given a very free hand. And meanwhile, the then Prime Minister Abbott was in China, and he had a business delegation with him, and he started to make a couple of calls that were not quite on the money, because they were trying to get me to say at the press conferences, it's down there, isn't it? And I said, no, I don't know, I can't tell
you. Yeah, again, truth is set you free.
So I was being pressured all the time, and I said, no, until we have evidence that it's down there.
This is another hallmark of Sir Angus Houston. You prepared to stand your ground.
No. Oh, well, you had to.
You had to. Well, get to the MH17, because that still is a big, who is responsible and should there be punishment?
Well, I was... I happened to be... I visited the Alamo.
Well, back to Sam Houston, are we?
Well, I was with a very good friend. We went to visit... I was with my wife. We're taking a break from 370, and we went to see some old friends we hadn't seen for many, many moons. And we arrived, when I... just after we arrived... I saw the footage of the crash of MH17, and I thought, oh no, not another one, and put it at the back of my mind, went off to the Alamo, and then we went down to the river, where all the restaurants are. I was about to have my first beer when the phone rang, and I picked up the phone. Tony Abbott, Prime Minister, how are you? Angus, I want you to go to Ukraine. I want you to lead our activities over there because, you know, we've got a big problem and I'd like you to lead it. Yes, Prime Minister. You can get the details from Andrew Shearer, a call, and he'll give you some of the detail.
Yes.
So I did that, and I was on a plane to Ukraine the next day through Germany, and I arrived and into Kiev, and of course there was a war raging down in the
Crimea.
Well, in the Donbass.
Oh, the Donbass. Then, of course, yeah.
Except this was being mounted by separatists.
Russian separatists, yes.
Supported by some Russian forces on the other side of the border. There was a huge force on the other side of the border. 30 battalion battle groups at the end. Anyway, I got there, I was briefed. Fortunately, the ambassador had been accredited to the Ukraine. She was our ambassador in Poland, and Jean Dunn, magnificent lady, tiny little lady, but well connected in Ukraine. And so we got in to see the host nation very quickly, talked to them about what we needed to do and so on, got all the necessary clearances to get onto the crash site. But the problem with the crash site was it was under the control of the separatists. So we're getting set up to do it. How we were going to do it was the big question. I started to see stuff from Australia that the Prime Minister wanted to deploy a battle group to secure the crash site and do the recovery operations that needed to be done. Anyway, I got a phone call in the wee small hours of the morning. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning. It was just starting to get light in Europe at that stage, and I walked around the square outside with my iPhone. I didn't have any secure comms or anything. He said, Angus, I need your advice. I want to put a battle group into the crash to secure the crash site. What do you think? And I said, Prime Minister, I don't think that's a good idea. I think what you need is a police-led force, which will present a non-threatening posture to the Russians.
It'll forever remain a question mark as to who actually shot down MH17.
The Dutch have done an investigation, a very thorough investigation, and they've identified, I think three or four people who they've charged with a crime, but they've got no hope of getting
them. Sir Angus, I know that you have another event coming up very shortly, so let me ask you two last questions, if I may. Liz, three sons, three granddaughters. How important has family been in your career?
Well, very important. I mean, my wife has basically sacrificed you know, everything to be with me, although as CDF she was down at Mulcara School, which is a special needs place, and she, while I was Chief of Air Force and Chief of Defence Force, she was doing that work. So it worked well through the 10 years of senior leadership, but through the rest of the time We went where we had to go, and like all service wives, my wife was very patient, very understanding, very supportive, and The kids, likewise. We sent them to boarding school. That was necessary when we were up in Malaysia, and indeed, we wanted them to have a stable education, so they went to Canberra Grammar. The grandchildren, well, they're a great joy, a great joy. And actually, the first one came along right at the end of I think it was she was 18 months when I left when I took off my uniform for the last time.
Well, you're still working for Australia, so you really haven't taken off your uniform. The last question, as one of Australia's leading leaders ever, what do you quantify as the qualities that a good leader should have?
Well, I think what's absolutely imperative is you've got to have integrity in that you have to lead by example, a good leader leads by example and has great respect for the people that he has been privileged to lead, and it's all about looking after the people. If you work tirelessly for the welfare of your people, their welfare, their safety, and you empower them, they'll follow you anywhere you want to go. So it's all about people establishing a good people culture, being able to work collaboratively, work in teams that all work together, and I think relationships at the highest level, relationships are incredibly important. I've never seen anything positive come out of an adversarial relationship, anything but. So people should always, as leaders, should strive for constructive relationships which build trust. And in my experience, the next thing that happens is you build influence. And that's been my experience in dealing with governments through the years.
Sir Angus, thank you very much for your role in developing the history of a very, very important defence force, the RAAF. Thank you for being such a good leader. Thank you for being such a good Australian. And Sir Angus Houston, I think, finally, Sam Houston from the Alamo would be proud of your career.
Globally, the RAAF has between 500 and 700 people on operations every day, contributing to coalition operations, peacekeeping and humanitarian and disaster relief. The RAAF takes pride in its service. It has a history of endeavour and sacrifice, which is one it a place in the hearts of all Australians and a position of respect among the armed services of all Australia's allies. The RAAF will never tarnish its record. It carries on in the proud tradition of Per Adua Ad Astra.
This is a series of podcasts recounting the personal stories of veterans and their families, produced by Air Force Association New South Wales, which is a registered charity that focuses on the well-being of Air Force veterans and their families. If you would like to donate funds to help us with this important work, you can search Air Force Association New South Wales in Google and go to our website.